So, Brian, I'll just get you first to just say your name and who you are, who you work for.
Brian McCormack, Kansas State University, Department of Entomology.
We're going to talk about pest control more specifically in a minute, but to start us off, could you give us an overview of the work you and your colleagues do through the Kansas State Drone Program?
Sure, I can do that. So I'm actually an associate professor here in entomology, and most of my area of study is around pest management and sampling. And I just, as part of this project here, probably about 2 years ago, working with our precision ag team, which is actually a team of agronomists and plant pathologists, and we've got a couple faculty in the breeding program, myself in entomology, a couple faculty in bioag engineering, veterinary medicine, and we're working with K-State Polytechnic as well, who actually has a UAS program for undergraduates. And we've been working on this program here for probably about 2 or 3 years, even though for K-State Polytechnic, it's gone back even further than that. They have a long history in unmanned aircraft systems.
On a more personal note, how do you as an entomologist become involved with flying drones?
To be honest, it's just my passion for technology. I actually have an appointment here, an extension that deals with mobile technology and digital delivery of information. Gadgets and gizmos are things I just love to try to incorporate in management decisions. And to me, the use of unmanned aircraft systems was just another tool to use to increase our ability to cover more area, to do our sampling a little bit more efficient.
How do drones factor into food security and monitoring agricultural systems?
You know, it's a great question, and I think it really depends on who you ask. I think drones have had a buzz in the media at least for the last 2 or 3 years, and what we're really pushing is to make sure our stakeholders, our growers, and our consultants really understand what the current limitations of the technology are and where we're headed. And part of that is about using these technologies to maximize yields, at least in the terms of agriculture. And the way in which we're doing that is, you know, again, working as a team, so we might all be looking at that same image that we collected with the UAS and interpreting it in slightly different ways. But that interpretation might not be as prescriptive as we want it to be, as we need it to be, to actually make a decision right now. And a lot of what we might be doing is using that technology to simply change our perspective, adding another layer of data, so to speak.
So to maybe focus the conversation a little bit more, get a bit more specific, let's dive into the work with pest control and diseases. What kinds of insects and diseases are you tracking, and what's the benefit of using drones to do it?
So for my lab, we primarily target insect pests, and with the grant that we're working on through the Australian government, it's a Plant Biosecurity Cooperative Research Center grant. Primarily, the system we work in is wheat, and we're targeting cereal aphids, primarily Russian wheat aphid and bird chariot aphid and green bug. We're also looking at other pests like hessian fly. Two of these, which happen to be invasive species for Australia, which is another reason why we're working with Australian colleagues on this particular grant, is to understand the data that we're collecting here in a landscape where those pests actually reside, and how do we detect those using unmanned aircraft systems. We've expanded this a little bit more outside of wheat, mainly because a primary objective of that grant is to really understand the utility and or limitations of UAS technology to remotely sense pests. And to do that, you know, at least what we're learning is that when you change to a new system, you go from wheat to sorghum, you start to deal with some more complicated issues, where the fruiting bodies change, where pests feed within the canopy change. So the signatures that we look for in images are going to change in correspondence to where the insects are, what kind of damage they're causing. So if we're going to be providing some type of recommendation on how to use UASs for remotely sensing invasive species, we have to have a pretty broad understanding of the limitations of the technologies across different types of plants.
Can you run us through what the work looks like in the field, the specific project, for instance?
Sure. You know, I think one of the other misconceptions is, you know, we take the UAS out, we fly it, we get some kind of prescriptive data, and then we make a decision. I think that's really the end goal. To kind of give you an example of what we're doing right now and how we collect that data, it's a much longer process. What we're trying to understand, again, is, or changes in that image and how that relates to a particular pest. To do that, for example, we set out some high-resolution global positioning system so that we get pixels that really, if we wanted to, we could ground truth them within a couple of centimeters. So that if a pixel shows up on an image, we have, you know, within 1 or 2 centimeters could actually find where that particular pixel resides within the landscape. Once we set that out, we take our unmanned aircraft system and put a few, in some cases, up to 3 sensors on it at a time, and fly a defined area. So we'll fly that at different speeds and different altitudes to figure out what's optimal for detecting a particular pest. And then while we're collecting the UAS imaging, then we'll do some ground truthing. So So we'll go out and at defined locations within that field that we're sampling, actually collect some data about the pest. For example, we've got a sugarcane aphid project where we fly a sorghum field, and then we come back and at specific points we'll collect information about populations, so how many aphids are on a plant, but then also how much damage is caused. And some of that might be direct damage, direct feeding, but some of it might be indirect, like amounts of honeydew or amounts of sooty mold that's colonizing on the honeydew. And then once we've collected the data, which can take, you know, anywhere from 2 to 3 hours, depending on how many flights we do, we'll bring that back and process the imaging, which actually takes another few hours to kind of get the high-resolution data we need to put with the ground truth data that we're getting, again, to come up with some type of predictive algorithm.
In your research, have you come across anything surprising, or...?
I think it's a great question, because I think one of the most surprising things to me was, you know, we talk about this as being an extra layer of data, but how much that extra layer really does provide in decision-making, to me, I think is really quite remarkable. I've been a part of a couple of UAS expos and gave some invited talks, and in conjunction with some other, you know, UAS companies that are kind of leading the way for the technology development. And it's really interesting to hear a lot of these companies as far as where they see the technology going, which is prescriptive. But in all honesty, we are a ways away from that. And I think one of the more immediate value we can get from the technology is simply changing our perspective. I'll give you an example of this. We were contacted by a grower just in north central Kansas who was having some problem with hessian fly in one of his wheat fields. And he was working with their insurance company on trying to determine whether or not they should, you know, put it to pasture, if they should till it and replant it, trying to figure out what their options were. So we met with them out there and took advantage of this and got some aerial imaging for a presentation I was going to give later. But we went out and started sampling, and where we were sampling, we were not necessarily seeing the issues that they thought they were seeing. And we were having a hard time kind of making a decision on what to do next. And so our plan of action was to come back in a week and reassess the situation. And during that, we were doing some orbit flight with our Inspire, which has a really good camera, and we're taking some video of it. We come back and we start looking at the video, and we were seeing a lot more that we weren't necessarily seeing in the field that was literally 10 to 15 feet away from us. And all we were doing, again, there was no predictive algorithm sitting in the background telling us, hey, there's hessian fly 10 feet from you. It was, again, giving us a different perspective on what we were seeing. So it really did inform us in a way that I was not expecting. And the answer was actually quite simple. It was provide, you know, a layer of data that is now 50 feet above you. We're showing you, you know, gaps in the rows that was difficult to see simply because of the perspective in which you were looking.
So you entered into a 3-year research partnership with the government of Australia last year. Tell me a bit more about that.
Sure. It's through the Australian Plant Biosecurity Cooperative Research Center, and this is an organization that has about 30 partners in it, some of which are industry, academia, and government. And this particular project, we got some researchers from Queensland University of Technology, and then a couple of other Australian government agencies that are all participating in this. But our project really boils down to, you know, as much as we want UASs to kind of be, you know, the answer for helping us do surveillance, to be practical about it, and if we give wheat as an example, in Kansas there's about 9 million acres of wheat. So to deploy UAS over all those acres is not realistic or really cost effective. And so one of our major questions is, how do we use knowledge about a pest to best determine where to deploy UAS technologies? And you know, a lot of that is predictive algorithms that use more information about the biology and overwintering and greatest likelihood of where that pest is going to be within a much larger area. And then once those areas are defined, that's then where we deploy UAS technology. Because again, it depends on which UAS system we use, whether it's a fixed wing or multi-rotor. We can only cover a certain amount of area and get higher resolution imaging. So part of that is there's satellite data available to some, like U.S., we've got some really good satellite data covering much of Kansas, and we can be leveraging that to best understand where to deploy UASs. So that's one of our first questions. The second question is, can we even get finer resolution to understand where we might need to remotely sample for a particular pest? And so that actually goes beyond imaging. And so instead of just acquiring another image that's higher resolution, maybe flown at a lower altitude, you can actually see damage in leaves. Maybe we need to actually collect a leaf to see if there's rust spores on it, to see if there's an aphid on the bottom side of the leaf. So part of our project is actually looking at the potential for what we call widgets, so little devices that we can add to a UAS or take off as needed to actually remotely collect the sample. Overall, the project project is more about how do we optimize the practices that we currently use to detect invasive species. And we're using established species within each country to understand, again, the utility of the technology. But it really kind of goes from this course level, where do we deploy, to once we've found a field to deploy, do we need to collect even higher resolution imaging to understand whether it's now actual insect feeding or if it's nutrient deficiency or if it's water stress? How do we tell the difference between biotic and abiotic stresses so that we kind of keep refining the resolution to a point where, okay, we think there's something here. Either we walk half an hour to the other end of the field, risk something not being there, or we attach a particular widget that might be a suction device that collects samples for us, brings it back to us, and saves us time.
So I feel like drone technology is interesting because of the convenience of it. It makes for ease of collecting data, but it's also a very expensive technology. Is it worth investing in this technology?
It might be relative to where you are and how much you'd be putting into resources like this. When you think about in terms of precision ag and what our growers here, at least in the U.S., are using to, you know, put the seed exactly where it needs to be and how much fertilizer needs to be on that plant, add in another data layer with a UAS, at this point will require a pilot. So again, it depends on the current regulations and how that might change. But right now, it would be more expensive simply because of the people that you'd be investing in, not necessarily the technology. For the system we fly, it has a pretty decent payload on it, so we can actually carry quite a few sensors. It's got a flight time of anywhere from 30 to 40 minutes, depending on, again, what we're carrying on it. A fixed wing, however, could cover a much larger area and have a flight time up to 45 minutes to an hour. But the technology itself may only be about $2,000 to $3,000. You know, considering how much acreage you could be covering, you know, how much manageable land you're going to be covering, the cost of the technology is not much. Where you're really going to be getting into the cost is really the person who's flying it. I think that will only change as the technology of U.S. gets better and as regulations relax a bit. Some of that might actually deal more with the safety requirements of the UAS. As that improves, I think it's going to be even more cost-effective. You know, for us, our average farm size might be around 1,000 to 1,200 acres. The cost of that technology might only be $2 or $3 an acre to fly. Again, assuming you don't have a pilot, and I think that's really where the biggest cost is right now. To meet the guidelines, you have to have a pilot's license, and you have to have certificates and exemptions to be able to fly the technology, and those come at a cost.
Going back to the original question, how does the research that you're doing benefit the use of drones for agriculture in the future?
So I think where some of the greatest value of the research we're doing is providing some of that baseline data, some guidance on the types of pests that best relate to signatures that really can be detectable with the technology we have. I think the coolest part in all this is, you know, we're working with bioag engineers who are the ones that are developing the sensors. You know, and as the sensor technology gets better and hopefully cheaper, because that's really one of the limiting factors is, you know, we talked about the price of the UAS, but really where most of the limitations are the sensor technologies. I mean, to fly a hyperspectral cam, which gives you a lot more bands, a lot more flexibility and indices, and something that might be predictable for a pest, might run around $80,000 for one camera.
Wow.
In 4 or 5 years' time, if there's a significant amount of demand, then that price can be reduced quite a bit. All of a sudden, there's a lot more utility in the technology. So I think some of the deliverables that our grant will have is kind of showing how to optimize the technology that we currently have, realizing there might be some limitations in the sensor technology for a given pest. But the bottom line is simply changing perspective actually adds quite a bit to what you might be sampling out in the field. So even if you ground truth it, you know that the pest is there, spend another 20 minutes flying over that area and now have high resolution imaging that you can stitch together to kind of go along with your ground truth data, again, provides a stronger zero or presence of a particular pest in an area. I think that's, you know, some more of the immediate value that this particular project can provide is figuring out how to use that perspective data to inform a management decision.
How do you see the evolution of drone technology? Where do you see drones being used in the future, and what obstacles currently stand in the way of farmers and researchers using drones more widely?
What I would like to see happen with the evolution of drone technology, the biggest issue for us is, you know, battery life. If we could find ways to extend battery life, increasing payloads so we can fly more sensors at a given time, But really the bottom line, any evolution in the technology needs to be focused on safety, because that's directly tied to regulations. So if we can make a UAS autonomous so it can fly on a path that we set, but at the same time if the technology fails, because again it's technology, it can happen, we want to make sure that it doesn't fail and human lives are compromised. So we want to make sure that the UAS, first of all, is safe. I think that's really where most of the regulations come in. That ties in with my next answer about your question regarding obstacles in the way of farmers and researchers using the technology, is that there are rules in place. And as much as we want those rules to be completely relaxed and give us some freedom to fly the technology to better understand it, I think we still need to do it safely. And I think that's where FAA, at least for us, have kind of put these regulations and guidelines in place, mainly because provide a safe flying environment. So I think, you know, as those relax, the technology develops and safety becomes more of a key focus. And regulations, I think, will relax more, and farmers and consultants, I think primarily consultants, will have to the technology. Because, you know, one other real limitation is, you know, as much as we can fly and get the data, but what do we do with the data? It's not a trivial task ahead of us. For example, that flight I talked about earlier over a small area might have taken up 40 to 50 gigs worth of images. That's something that we're not going to be able to upload to the cloud and get analyzed. We might have to have some software that's with us in the field to do that. But at the end of the day, if we're covering thousands of hectares of land, where's that data going to go? And then who's going to be able to look at it to help understand how to interpret the data and make a management decision from it? This is an example I give is, you know, we can fly a field of sorghum and we can stitch it together, but if you give it to an entomologist, a pathologist, a weed scientist, a fertility specialist, you name it, irrigation specialists, they might all have a slightly different take on what's happening in that image. So for us to have an image that's prescriptive, we need to actually take a couple steps back and really find more effective ways to communicate as scientists across disciplines to make use of this data that's coming out of this technology. But again, in more immediate term, I think we can leverage simply changing our perspective. Where do we sample within the field? And I've given this example in talks with growers and consultants and talking about the value of the technology. I show a slide that has, you know, some irregularities in it, and I don't tell them what it is, but I split it up into four, A, B, C, and D. Just tell me where you would start sampling. And most of them will start sampling wherever it's closest to the road, because it goes back to convenience, and they have a lot of acreage to sample. But then I give them one more added layer of information, which is, you know, sugarcane aphid and sorghum causes some sooty mold, so you'll start to see darkening the leaves. Well, there's a patch in one of those squares that looks like that description. And nearly everybody changes their answer to A, because that's where the patch resides. Again, there was no prescriptive algorithm that looked at that image and told them where to sample. It was an extra layer of data and helped them inform that decision on where should they at least sample or include in their decision making. So again, as the technology evolves, safety will be the primary driver. As farmers and consultants start to use the technology more, what I hope is they don't get frustrated that the prescriptive algorithms are not there yet, because as scientists, we need to kind of step back and figure out how we're going to do that a little bit better before we just hand over the technology to those that are expected to make decisions with it.